This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Sometimes places we don't see or care about can change rapidly, and then that ripples around the world, coming back to us. Antarctica is one of those places. Events there will redraw the maps of coastlines, drown famous cities, and change weather in the southern hemisphere. Our tiny local paper mentioned Antarctica last week. It's one of a chain of advertising platforms owned by a media baron, and he hires climate deniers and social haters as his op-ed columnists. We get to read that every week. Our chain Grinch told readers one proof there is no global warming, or if there is, we didn't do it, is sea ice expanding around Antarctica. Why those eggheads in lefty university science departments didn't predict that when the world is supposed to be getting hotter, did they? Except he's wrong. Untold by his paper and most others, the sea ice around Antarctica has crashed further and faster than the famous disappearing sea ice in the Arctic. We are going to explore that story with one of the most senior climate scientists and satellite specialists at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. She has tracked polar ice sheets from space for decades. Then, part two of my series, Retreat from the Coast. Sooner or later, rising seas combined with higher storm surges will force a mass migration from the coastlines all over the world. 2 weeks ago, in my show broadcast September 25th, we heard Dr. A.R. Siders on research which I would characterize as, do we plan or do we panic? Find that interview in my blog at ecoshock.org. This week, we discover there is a whole group of professionals in America already organizing to plan out ways to cope with the ocean as it moves into the land during this century and many centuries to come. Since 1978, Dr. Claire Parkinson has been a climatologist at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. She is currently their senior scientist for climate change. She's also project scientist for AQUA, the multi-tooled satellite launched in May 2002. We are calling Claire now about the sudden collapse of sea ice, not in the Arctic, but around Antarctica. Claire Parkinson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. I'm glad to be here.
When Arctic sea ice crashed around 2007, I remember it, my jaw dropped, a lot of scientists were surprised. But meanwhile, at the other pole, ice was spreading further away from Antarctica. It was getting bigger. And that was different from what models predicted under global warming. Do we know why Antarctic sea ice was expanding then?
We definitely do not have a consensus viewpoint on that. There have been quite a few attempts at explanations. But the increases continued until 2014, which is when it reached the peak for the Antarctic. And after that, it's been more on the downward trend. But we do not have agreed upon consensus explanations for why it was increasing. It's definitely a puzzle for scientists at this point.
Right. That was my guess, too, when I started looking at earlier papers from 2016 and earlier explaining that expansion. And they were talking about all sorts of things from teleconnections to great big cycles to atmospheric changes, ocean current changes. And when you've got that many answers, it means you probably don't have the answer.
That's exactly right. And as you said, oscillations have been part of the attempted explanations, and atmospheric phenomena, ocean phenomena, also the land ice. As the land ice melts into the oceans, it's putting in very, very cold water. And so that's been an attempted explanation also of why the sea ice was in expanding.
So when did Antarctic sea ice stop expanding and enter into a kind of crash, and how fast did it contract?
Okay, it was 2014 when it reached its peak. And then from 2014 to 2017 in particular, those 3 years showed a huge decrease. The decrease was far faster than any of the decrease that we've seen in the Arctic. And it was basically, in terms of how fast it was, it decreased a total of a little bit over 2 million square kilometers in just those 3 years. That comes out to an area that exceeds the area of Mexico. So more than the area of Mexico is how much aerial expanse of sea ice decrease there was from 2014 to 2017 in terms of a yearly average basis.
And it's strange because we've heard a lot of worry and panic about the disappearance of Arctic sea ice, but I don't know that most of the public realizes that Antarctica stopped enlarging and started crashing.
I don't think that most people realize that either, so I think you're correct on that. And the Arctic has, as you said, received a lot of attention since the late 1990s, essentially. And it's deserved a lot of it, but this huge decrease in the Antarctic is much, much faster than what the Arctic decreases have been.
The precipitous reversal of a trend in Antarctic sea ice sounds like some kind of system switch was triggered. What do we know about what caused the big change in the sea ice there?
There again, we do not have a consensus viewpoint on that. The evidence indicates that in the early and mid-1970s, there was also a very rapid decrease of Antarctic sea ice. And that's before the record that started in late 1978, the 40-year record that peaked in 2014. So for some reason, the Antarctic has experienced two periods of really rapid sea ice decreases, one in the 1970s and one from 2014 and the next few years after that. And the Arctic has not, in the time frame of our satellite records, has not experienced anything anywhere close to that kind of decrease. And so it could be related to the very different geographies in the two cases. If you think about the Arctic, you realize that the Arctic sea ice cover is largely confined by the land area around the Arctic. So the Arctic sea ice cover is largely in the Arctic Ocean and surrounded by Europe and Asia and North America and Greenland. Whereas the Antarctic, if you think about the geography of the Antarctic, the central polar region is the Antarctic continent, not sea ice, but instead the continent. And the sea ice is around the continent, and it is not prevented from going further equatorward because instead it's bounded by Pacific Ocean, Indian Ocean, Atlantic Ocean. So it's oceans that are to its equatorward side. And so therefore it can expand out a lot more readily than the Arctic ice can.
Now, did I get this right? It seemed to me during my research that the Arctic ice is melting mainly because of sun heating the top of it, whereas Antarctic sea ice was melting more because of warm water melting it up from the bottom. Is that right?
Even that is not certain. The Arctic ice is very much connected with the warming in the Arctic. The Arctic has a strong record of warming over this period of the last few decades. It's definitely warming quite a bit faster than the globe as a whole. And that's both increasing the melt of the ice, but it's also being fed by the melt of the ice. And the way that that happens is the ice is white, it's highly reflective, so most of the sun's radiation that comes down and reaches the sea ice cover gets reflected off and goes back to space. If the sea ice cover retreats, which it's been doing in the Arctic, then there's solar radiation in some areas of the Arctic will come down, and instead of hitting the ice and getting reflected back to space, instead hits the liquid ocean and goes into the ocean, warms the ocean up, and stays within the Earth atmosphere system so that it contributes to the further warming. This is what scientists call a positive feedback. I prefer to call it an enhancing feedback just because the word positive in a lot of people's minds means good, and that's not the meaning in this particular case. So that feedback was anticipated. Everybody knows that, well, climate scientists know that a reduction in sea ice is going to have this effect of less solar radiation being reflected back to space, and therefore contributes to a further warming. So in the Arctic, things seemed so understandable in terms of the way things were going were right in line with what the expectations were with warming and lessened sea ice, therefore more warming and more or lessened sea ice. And the whole pattern in the Arctic fit. So there's less land ice, less sea ice. There's warming temperatures in the atmosphere, warming temperatures in the ocean, permafrost melting. So a whole pattern of changes all fit. In the Antarctic, it just was not fitting like we had expected. So the Antarctic was definitely the more puzzling case.
But if an area the size of Mexico changes from dark sun-absorbing to light reflective, or the other way around in this case, where the Antarctic lost sea ice, would that also not tend to add heat to the oceans around Antarctica?
Definitely. It definitely would.
Now, another thing that people have been guessing at in all this is that in recent years we've seen erratic weather in the northern hemisphere, partly due to north-south waves forming in the jet stream, which should be from west to east. Has the jet stream changed around the South Pole, and is that a factor in the retraction of sea ice cover?
Definitely the thought is that atmospheric changes could very likely be factors. You would have to ask an atmospheric scientist to get the details correct on that, but atmospheric changes are definitely thought to be a factor.
And what is the state of Antarctic sea ice now in 2019, and are there projections for this year?
Well, right now, the sea ice is low compared to what it was this time of year back in 2014 when it was up at its highest levels, but it's a little bit higher than it was in 2017 and 2018. So there's been a slight rebound from the previous 2 years, but still the trend from 2014 high point, the trend is still downward. It's still well below what it had been in the years prior to 2015.
In July, you published the paper titled "A 40-Year Record Reveals Gradual Antarctic Sea Ice Increases, Followed by Decreases at Rates Far Exceeding the Rates Seen in the Arctic." That was in PNAS. And in the discussion section, we find, quote, "This illustrates that the ice decreases since 2014 are no assurance that the 1979-2014 overall positive trend in Southern Ocean ice extents has reversed to a long-term negative trend. Could you clarify that about what we know and what we don't?"
Fortunately, since the 1970s, we've had satellite data that really give us a good picture of the extent and distribution of the sea ice in each hemisphere. So we've got a good record of that. What we don't know is the future. So we know that the ice aerial extent was increasing overall. Now, there's a lot of interannual variability in both hemispheres. But we know the Antarctic sea ice overall was increasing from the late 1970s until 2014. We know that it decreased dramatically over the next 3 years. In fact, so dramatically that in that 40-year record that you just mentioned, from 1979 to 2018, so in that 40-year record, the very highest yearly average was in 2014. The very lowest was in 2017. So in just those 3 years, it went from the highest to the lowest. So huge change there. So we know from the satellite data that that's basically what happened. Now, the satellite data aren't absolutely perfect. We can't say that we know to the nearest 100 kilometers what's right, but we're talking about millions of kilometers of ice here. And so we do know from the satellite data the basics. What we don't know is what the future will bring. So in the 1970s, when there is this indication of a very rapid decrease before the 40-year record started, that decrease reversed. And so, therefore, there is the possibility with some evidence from the past that the decrease we've seen from 2014 on, that decrease could reverse too. So we do know that that's a possibility. On the other hand, we also know that overall the Earth's atmosphere is warming, and the projections from the best computer models that we have are pretty uniform in terms of indicating that the warming will overall be continuing. It's not like each year is warmer than the year before, but the long trend is toward warming. So therefore, that would be a scenario in which one would expect that there's a strong possibility that the Antarctic sea ice might continue to decrease instead of rebounding like it did from the 1970s. So that's why in the paper I indicated that we don't know. It could go either way.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest, Claire Parkinson, is author of more than 100 scientific publications and author or editor of at least a dozen books, including An Atlas of Arctic Sea Ice. And we are talking about a remarkable loss of sea ice around Antarctica. So if there's less sea ice around the southern pole, at least for a while, does that affect things like coastal erosion on Antarctica or the speed of glaciers discharging ice to the sea?
It certainly affects coastal erosion, and that's certainly been an effect in the Arctic too. And that's basically because if you've got sea ice that's right along the coast, then the waves from the ocean can't so easily strike the coast and cause more coastal erosion. And so when the ice retreats and you end up with land areas that the ocean can strike right into, you can get more coastal erosion. Now, along a large part, the majority, in fact, of Antarctica, it's not dry land that's right up against the ocean. It's instead the Antarctic ice sheet. And so that affects things a bit. But certainly the loss of sea ice right along the coast does have an effect of increasing coastal erosion.
Well, as you know, Claire, a few scientists are so alarmed about the warming impacts of losing Arctic sea ice, they propose launching sulfates or some other material to block out some of the sun. And the goal of that geoengineering would be to preserve the remaining sea ice. Claire, do you think that could or should be done?
I'm concerned by that. My feeling is that humans have poured a lot of materials into the atmosphere and into the oceans, and certainly the indication is that these have done some harm. Now, really, our models are not good enough to be sure of the consequences of different things, and so I would much prefer for us not to try to solve a problem that we created by pouring something even more into the atmosphere. So I would much prefer personally to try to solve it by either taking the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and some people are thinking of schemes of doing that, and that would also come under the term of geoengineering, or trying to use other sources of energy so that we're not pouring as much into the atmosphere as we've been doing, or to try to change lifestyles so that we don't need as much. So, you know, reusing things, giving things away instead of throwing them away, and just using less if possible.
I think those are the answers I would choose as well, but maybe we shouldn't even be worried about swings in the sea ice around Antarctica. Perhaps it doesn't really matter that much. What do you think?
I can understand why the concern would be greater in the Arctic, because you do have communities living in the Arctic that are being affected by changes in sea ice. And you do have the polar bears, which are so iconic, and it's clear that the loss of sea ice does hurt the polar bears in terms of their lifestyle. And so I understand why the Arctic might generate more concerns, and also because changes in the Arctic do have more impacts on the weather in the Northern Hemisphere and including in the U.S. But the Antarctic is important also, and the loss of ice in the Antarctic is going to increase the amount of solar radiation absorbed within the Earth's atmosphere system, in particular in the Antarctic oceans, and that's going to contribute in the long term also. Another concern would be the land ice situation. So in the Antarctic, you've got way more land ice. And in terms of the extremely important concern about sea level rise, it's the land ice that matters, not the sea ice. Sea ice is already in the oceans, so if it goes away, it's not affecting sea level. But the land ice, if that melts or calves off into icebergs, that's adding water or ice to the oceans, and it's causing sea level rise. And in that case, the Antarctic is where the huge bulk of land ice is. So in the Arctic, you've got Greenland, which is the second largest bulk of ice, but the Antarctic is the one that's got the huge majority of land ice on this planet.
There's a rash of fires in Australia already in their early springtime, and meanwhile in New Zealand it's been pretty cold and wet, and Patagonia too, and scientists are pointing towards a sudden stratospheric warming event that just appeared over Antarctica in the first couple of weeks of September. There was an 80 degree C rise in temperature in the upper atmosphere, which is astounding. Do you know anything about that, or is that something for an atmospheric scientist to speak to?
That is definitely something for an atmospheric scientist. I do know a little about it, and I do know that the expectation is maybe it will affect the ozone hole this year. In fact, maybe having the ozone conditions improve this year, and the ozone in the stratosphere and in the upper atmosphere.
So when the satellites look at it, has the ozone hole stabilized, or has it actually decreased as we hoped it would, or do we have to wait till 2070 to see the final end of this thing?
Oh, the ozone hole comes out really clear on some of the satellite results. The satellite results that show plots of the size of the ozone hole have shown that that size was increasing dramatically in the 1980s. Then the Montreal Protocol to reduce the emissions of chlorofluorocarbons, that Montreal Protocol, which was signed in 1987, that had a very good effect. And you can see it in these plots where the rapid increase in the size of the ozone hole in the 1980s has kind of leveled off. Now, leveling off means it's still up there high, much higher than it was in 1980. And so you could still sometimes expect that you might get another record high in terms of the size. But it's leveled off in terms of it is no longer just on this rapid rise. And the same thing in terms of the depth of the ozone hole. And what that means is how low do the values get in terms of the amount of ozone. And those plots show that the amount of ozone, the depth was going way down very fast in the 1980s and then has been slowly going up a bit since then. So you can definitely see from the plots from the satellite data that there's been an improvement over what it would have been, but it's nowhere close to getting back to the levels of ozone in the upper atmosphere that were there in 1980.
You started at NASA the very year they launched the Nimbus 7 satellite, and that was the first that could record sea ice cover around Antarctica, and before that we were kind of blind. Now please tell us, what does the AQUA satellite do?
Okay, to quickly answer on the AQUA satellite, the AQUA satellite wasn't launched until 2002, and that measures all sorts of things. It measures lots of phenomena in the atmosphere, including clouds and carbon dioxide and methane and aerosols. It measures different things in the ocean, including chlorophyll, including ocean temperatures. It measures sea ice. It measures land ice. It measures vegetation on the land. So the AQUA satellite is a very multi-purpose satellite, and it was launched in 2002. Your comment about the satellite that was launched in 1978, that was actually Nimbus 7, and there had been a previous satellite called Nimbus 5. And Nimbus 5, which was launched in December of 1972, Nimbus 5 did have an instrument on it that could measure the sea ice and did measure the sea ice and got a four-year record. That instrument measured microwave radiation, and there's this huge, huge advantage of using microwave radiation to get sea ice coverage in the Arctic and the Antarctic for climate purposes. And the huge advantages include that the microwave is coming from within the Earth system itself. So it's not reflected sunlight. So if you think about it, if you've got an instrument up on a satellite that measures visible radiation, the type that our eyes see, that satellite is going to have all the advantages, but also all the disadvantages of our eyes. So if it's a nice clear day and sunny out, you're going to, with a visible instrument on board the satellite, you're going to see the sea ice just like our eyes would be able to see it. So this is great. You get pictures that our eyes can readily understand. But the microwaves, they are coming from within the Earth atmosphere system. So therefore, you can get your pictures from the microwaves, whether it's day or night, you do not need sunlight, and you can get it even if it's cloudy out, because the microwave radiation in general can go straight through most clouds. So we can, with the microwave instruments, see through the clouds and get our data, whether it's daytime or night, whether it's cloudy or not cloudy. So in 1972, this Nimbus 5 satellite carried on board an instrument that was essentially a proof of concept instrument, and it was able to measure the microwave radiation coming up. We spent a lot of time analyzing the data from that instrument, which got a record for 4 years before it ceased giving good data. The Nimbus 7, that was the one that was launched in October of 1978, that had a much improved instrument on board measuring the microwave radiation. And it's that record from October 1978 that we have a really solid record of the sea ice cover. So we did have some satellite data before that, but it wasn't as good quality.
Last question, Claire Parkinson. I know you have been an inspiration for many women scientists. Who inspired you?
Oh, that's a tougher question than you might have meant it to be. Wow. Well, I actually am inspired by a lot of people. In general, people who have overcome difficulties of one type or another. Yeah, I'm inspired more by people who've like overcome various disorders rather than by scientists in particular.
I love that. I hear exactly what you're saying. We've been speaking with Claire Parkinson, a trailblazing scientist gathering satellite data about Earth and our climate. She is senior scientist at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center and project scientist for Aqua Satellite. Find links to her recent paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Claire, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
Alex, thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
As Hurricane Dorian showed us again, storm surge rises ever higher when more powerful hurricanes start from a base of rising seas. Doesn't anyone see that many islands and coasts around the world will have to be abandoned? Is America ready to leave Miami and so many other coastal towns and ports? Should we plan for that or just wait for the collapse and the coming panic? And where will everybody go? Our next guest is on the ground floor of that planning in America. When Patrick Marchman first contacted me around 7 years ago, he was frustrated working for FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And that was before Trump appointed incompetent leaders and slashed the FEMA budget. Now Patrick is a member of the Agenda Setters for the Climate Migration Network. That's a new word to me, climate migration. And he founded the Climate Migration and Managed Retreat Member Interest Group at the American Society of Adaptation Professionals. Marchman has a master's degree in marine affairs from the University of Washington in Seattle. He is a certified environmental planner. Patrick Marchman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it isn't just the federal government. I mean, is it fair to say that everyone from state governors to chambers of commerce to real estate developers, they all hope you and I will just shut up and go away with this leave the coast talk?
That's an interesting way to put it. I think you're absolutely right. It is not just the federal government or national governments at all. It's in general, it's a lot easier to not really plan. And again, as I mentioned, you know, adaptation itself has been sort of for a long time, it was kind of the thing we weren't supposed to talk about. It was considered defeatist. We were supposed to be talking about mitigating climate change. And, you know, we're just now getting the point to realize that we're not going to be able to mitigate our way out of some of this stuff. We're going to have to adapt. And that starts bringing things down to really, really intimate levels. It's not going to really be a matter of just changing a light bulb anymore. It's going to start having to impact on zoning regulations, on, you know, the basic questions of the value of housing. And there's an awful lot of, you know, interest. We've built entire economies around the idea that, you know, your house is the greatest asset you'll ever have. And so this is going to call that into question, among other things.
To your knowledge, does the U.S. government have a secret master plan to withdraw from coastal areas that will be flooded by rising seas and super storm surges? Do they have something in the back drawer there?
To my knowledge, no. And it would be, frankly, at times it would be nice if they did. There's a lot of different parts of the federal government, and they're all thinking, you know, different things. But, you know, if there's a master plan, I'd like to see it.
So what is the American Society of Adaptation Professionals?
The American Society of Adaptation Professionals, we use the acronym ASAP. It's a relatively new professional organization, a little over 1,000 people, and it's basically dedicated to advancing the profession of climate adaptation. It has a lot of researchers involved, but also practitioners on the ground at various levels. Pretty much anyone who's interested in trying to address the impacts of climate change in day-to-day planning and other works. It's very small, and there's a lot of opportunities to get involved, which is how I ended up being able to do the work that I'm doing.
So tell us about the Climate Migration and Managed Retreat member interest group.
The interest group I came up with the idea with around fall of 2018. It seemed a bit of a breaking of the dam in terms of media when a lot of outlets started actually talking about the issue of managed retreat and communities starting to relocate. And the ASAP put out a call for member interest groups, and basically these would be groups that members could suggest and would be able to run largely on their own. So I got together with a few people. We wrote a proposal, and it happened to be accepted. So we've been going since April 2019, and it's been really gratifying to see the level of interest among members and people outside the organization in what we're doing.
Who are some of the guests speaking to the Migration and Retreat Group, and what are they saying?
We've had a kind of a range of guests. Since it's climate migration and managed retreat, we're talking at different scales, from the very large scale down to the very intimate. So we try to have speakers that reflect that. We've had researchers like A.R. Siders from the University of Delaware. We've had specialists on international migration. We've had filmmakers, such as the maker of the film Tidewater, about the impacts of sea level rise on the Hampton Roads area in Virginia. I tried to be a bit conscious in inviting voices that aren't specifically just those same white males, and trying to have a bit of diversity in the outlooks we're presenting to our members.
And we've seen a couple of examples of people just dispersing from cities. I'm thinking of New Orleans after Katrina, when I don't know how many people, 10,000 people, 100,000 people just left and never came back. It wasn't planned. It was all of a sudden, almost overnight, and they were all out there to Denver and Tennessee and wherever, and to Houston. And then we had, after Puerto Rico, Hurricane Maria, at least 100,000 people left for the mainland right after that storm, and we don't know how many have ever gone back. But that immigration, it's not planned by anybody, and the people arriving have nobody there to welcome them or help them. It's all very haphazard, isn't it?
It is. In some ways, you could almost call it unmanaged retreat. When people lose their homes, they're going to move. They're going to try to find a better, you know, a decent life for themselves and their families. And it's hard to measure a lot of this, you know, especially with Hurricane Katrina. We weren't even really thinking in these terms yet. But I think, you know, what you see in Puerto Rico and what you'll see in the future, you can even see some of this in terms of sort of the almost an out-migration from portions of the Midwest after the large flooding in spring 2019. It's hard to really call that a climate migration, but a lot of people have just decided simply to give up on the farm. You know, it's just too much. And so how do you account for that? That's going to have a material impact. It's going to, you know, affect the future shape of the communities that they've left behind.
Some South Pacific Islanders who can see their homes flooding regularly right now have already arranged safe exits to places in Australia and New Zealand. National governments have agreed on that plan. Why aren't there similar plans within the United States, which has thousands of miles of coastlines, where the sea will march inland?
That's a great question. Part of it is simply the political environment. I wouldn't just blame the current administration. It's down to local communities. You know, we have the United States especially, you know, a lot of other countries are in the same boat, but in the United States, there is so much value in terms of real estate and community that it's pouring into the coast. In a lot of ways, the coastal counties in the United States are the fastest growing sections of the country. And so in some ways, you have people rushing to the coast as the coast is rushing to meet them. It's a very hard thing to sit there and tell people the basis of who are going to be the basis of your economy. You know, there's really not a whole lot of future in some of the places you're moving to. So there's that. There's also just simply the interaction between different layers of government in the United States. And then, of course, there is the fact that the national government right now doesn't really want to acknowledge the existence of some of what's going on. And so that makes it very difficult to even start coordination. There are good efforts going on in different places. California has done a lot of good work, and other some surprising areas as well. But, you know, in terms of a national strategy, I really don't see one on the horizon.
And I think it comes right down to the individual. I mean, the average person always thinks they'll return home no matter what. And they talk after a big disaster from local political leaders, so whether it's a flood or a storm or a fire, it's always about, we will rebuild, of course. And they want to rebuild the same maladapted structures and infrastructure, the same patterns, right back into the same danger zone. We've got to find a way to get out of that kind of suicidal loop.
You're absolutely right. I've heard a term called the psychology of previous investment, which explains a lot of this. You know, we've put so much effort and so much money and so many resources into something we have a hard time imagining that we have a hard time giving up on that. And I think, you know, and that's sort of one of the things we're trying to examine. We're trying to find ways to break out of maybe some of the false dichotomies of either you have to build exactly the way you built or you have to give up entirely. We're trying to think of different options, including more intelligent retreat from shorelines or from floodplains where, you know, intensifying rains are making certain housing patterns untenable. We're trying to really encourage people and planners of the future that there are other options.
You know, I used to think that the role of private insurance companies would be strong because they would just say, well, we're not going to insure these places anymore. And they have said that on a lot of coastal properties, but it doesn't matter because the state government fills in with their own insurance, even though we don't believe in socialism, of course. And I just don't see how the insurance thing is going to help. It's almost become like nuclear power plants. Nobody will insure a nuclear power plant, so the federal government said, well, we will, even though the federal government is totally broke. Taking on giant public risks for the people who are living in their pretty expensive real estate down by the coasts, and the rest of us are supposed to pay for it.
That is a recognized issue, and I will say to the credit of a lot of people, there's a lot of discussion and hope in reforming some of the excesses of that you're speaking about. The National Flood Insurance Program has done a lot of things for a lot of people, but it also in some ways has had some perverse incentives, and there's a lot of people trying to think through how to do that differently. But in terms of private insurance, that's sort of the next frontier of what we're talking about in some ways, because some of the fires that have happened in California, you know, you're eventually going to see, you know, certain areas where the insurance, it's just going to be too high. They're just simply going to pull out. And I would go beyond that in terms of not just the private insurance, but recently in the past couple months, I think the mayor of Honolulu made a bit of a statement in an interview that creditors are starting to ask cities about their climate action plans and how they're going to fund those. So you're actually starting to see the big money starting to want answers about this sort of thing.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is environmental planner Patrick Marchman. We are talking about planned migration to safer places as climate change advances. And, you know, Patrick, humans do adapt, and sometimes that can just stall the real solution. For example, I'm thinking about heat deaths in countries from the United States to India have gone down with government planning around cooling centers and better notification and closing schools and all that. But that means it just gets hotter and hotter, and we may take it less seriously because fewer people die. That's the headline, how many die. That's all that's important, apparently. And the same can be said for any disaster management. If we perfect our temporary evacuation so that hardly anyone dies, but we miss the point. We just can't afford to keep coming back to a place when it goes underwater for half the year. What are your thoughts on all that, Patrick?
I think you make a very good point. I think it's some temporary adaptations can be almost an excuse to not think things more holistically and more long-term. That doesn't preclude the need for adaptation. We are going to have to adapt. That's simply the way it's going to be at this point. I think we missed our window decades ago to mitigate our way out of this. You know, when we're actually trying to think of things just beyond more efficient evacuations, it's going to have to be thinking decades down the line, which there are some people who are starting to think that way, and it's very exciting to be in the middle of that, to at least be at the beginning of those conversations, but it is so little. When you see, for example, in some initiatives regarding the managed retreat, you can retreat, you can push, you know, resettle homeowners and build new homes maybe a mile or two, even, you know, further away from a shoreline. But the question comes, you know, what happens in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, because the sea is not going to stop. In fact, it's going to accelerate. It does get to be almost an emotional thing. How do you let go? How do you have the ability to let go and be able to build differently? And that's a very tough thing.
And here's another strange wrinkle. A lot of the folks who fled Hurricane Katrina when New Orleans flooded, they went to Houston. And within 2 years, some of the same people got flooded out of Houston and had to go to other places like Tennessee. Do you think that over this generation there could be a problem of multiple migrations?
I think it's absolutely certain there will be. And I think, you know, we're still not thinking long-term enough. For instance, someone from Katrina, of course, will end up going to Houston. That's where their family is. But unless you have this in the front of their mind, this sort of thing will happen. It's going to be haphazard in some degree, but it's going to be tough. And I would expect sort of like, you know, there'll be multiple layers of sort of you maybe even are able to start to use the word migration. I know that there's some initiatives that are beginning to try to examine on state levels what the in-migration impacts the states are going to be. And I think you're exactly right. It's going to just it's going to get more and more so as time goes on. I think cities and communities really need to start preparing for that.
When you contacted me recently, you wanted to find artists and activists and authors to help plant these ideas and push the planning process. Why go outside scientists and professionals?
Because as wonderful and amazing as scientists have been and professionals such as myself have been, you know, we can do all the work we can, but, you know, at some level, it's not breaking through. It hasn't. If scientists and professionals were all that it took, we could have solved climate change and a lot of things quite a long time ago, but it's simply not. We can talk about the facts all we want. We can talk about zoning regulations, and it's not going to get through to a lot of people. I think what will get through to people is really touching sort of, you know, sort of beyond the intellect. We'll be touching, you know, emotions. We'll be touching the sense of history, the sense of self. So when you're talking about the idea, the basic idea is that people are going to have to move, that a lot of what they've invested in their entire lives and generations are going to have to be uprooted. It's not just a question of, you know, here's the numbers. It's a question of, well, are they going to be, what will become of their sense of identity? What will become of their communities? And I think it's in that we really do need the artists. We need the writers. We need psychologists. We need the people in the humanities to really start thinking about what this is going to mean. It's going to be much, much bigger than just the matter of where you're going to build a new house for someone.
Yeah, and I think those people could also help with another aspect of this, which is that we can't just frighten people out of their homes. We can't just say, well, you're going to be burned out or flooded out, so you might as well move. We're going to have to offer some sort of vision of how things could be even more positive. And I go back to the model of the old American West when people left New England and the central states. They saw the West as freedom, as space, where they were going to have their own farms and they were going to be able to develop their lives. And if we can show people the vision of a safer future where you're going to be able to do more instead of always having to be worried that the next one's going to get you, I think that could be a positive thing if we can get that out there.
I think so, too. I think when I hear this, I think of sort of the model of the in urban planning, the movement called the New Urbanism that really kind of took off around the, you know, the 2000s and such. And the idea, you know, in that is, you know, we can criticize the car culture all we want, and the criticisms are absolutely 100% valid, probably understated. However, part of it is also creating a new alternative that is attractive. The idea of walkability is influencing health, building community, making something people would aspire to, something people want. And eventually you sort of started to see this in a lot of real estate markets, and people are actually valuing these sort of old-fashioned, you know, characteristics. And I think that sort of same idea in terms of, you know, yes, people are going to have to leave for reasons they don't want to, but, you know, if we can create something that it's not going to be merely a tragedy, but something that they can look forward to, that they can, you know, help build their lives, I think that's going to be an amazing thing. There's a gentleman I admire, Rob Hopkins of the Transition Movement, and I know he's recently been talking about imagination. And I think, you know, being able to imagine things could be different is so, so powerful. And I think it's that that's going to be what's going to allow us to really think about, you know, how is it that we can, you know, make people's lives better, give them possibilities that will make some of these transitions maybe not so painful and indeed maybe beneficial for some people.
Yeah, I could see YouTube channels and social media, Facebook pages, that sort of thing, where people get together to talk about the places they would really like to live and how they can get together to share resources to get there and that sort of thing. It doesn't have to be a dread leaving of the coast with tears in your eyes.
No, it doesn't. And I think, you know, and it's sort of a, another factor of that is you having to think about the receiving communities as well. And because there's going to be a lot of people on, say, in northern U.S. states such as Michigan and such who are going to be eventually looking at this and saying, well, there's going to be large numbers of people who are coming our way. And as we've seen, people can be very scared of refugees, and that's what is different. And so, you know, we have to be able to find ways to do that differently. And so, you know, kind of maybe not make some of the same mistakes we've been making. And also think about people who have been there before. You know, there's a risk that, you know, gentrification could occur when newcomers with a lot of money come in and start displacing people of low income who've been there or indigenous people. And so, you know, again, being able to think differently and be conscious about this, I think, is our best shot to avoiding some of those more negative outcomes.
What about free online seminars for the public presented by the Society of Adaptation Professionals to get people thinking about these things before disasters strike?
That's an interesting idea. We actually, the webinars we have right now are open for the public if they're interested. You know, we have probably a little ways to go in getting this more publicly available. You know, right now it's for practitioners outside of the bounds of the organization. But, you know, I think that's a definite possibility. I think, you know, again, kind of getting out and communicating with ordinary people, I think, not just through webinars, but, you know, practitioners on the ground, planners, developers on the ground who are aware of these sort of things, I think in their work with local governments and with the public as well, can do an awful lot to kind of reduce some of the, kind of lower the temperature a bit and kind of reduce some of the fear and anxiety around the topic.
Well, here's an impossibly big question, but let's take a shot at it. Let us imagine that someone sane is elected as President of the United States, and they appoint someone with your kind of expertise to head up the disaster agency, FEMA. What are the first steps?
Assuming that happens, I think some of the first steps will be to start being able to coordinate all of the massive resources, not only on the U.S. federal level, but state level. There's a lot of money sloshing around, and be able to coordinate a lot of this and to really start addressing not only preparation for disasters, but really start to have a bit of what one might say a come to Jesus moment, which is, you know, look, there are things happening right now. There is sunny day flooding happening right now in Miami, a major American city, and that's just the first. It's going to keep happening, and it's going to get, there's more and more and more of this in our future. So we need to think about this intelligently. We need to direct our funding. We need to direct our orientation, you know, to really truly building resilience. And I think there's been a lot of steps made toward that. But I think, you know, there's so much more to do. And I think being able to coordinate on different levels of government, coordinating, you know, the private sector as well. And I think, you know, it's just really going to take a sort of a national and international conversation in some ways to really get people to rethink some of these things and rethink the ideas of what is it going to mean to relocate. What is going to be lost and what can be gained, and what is there to fear and what there isn't. And I think a lot of times, you know, we respond because of our fears. And I think actually looking at this and examining this and holding this out in the open could help moderate a lot of things that have been happening.
Well, I totally agree with that. But we had a guest on this show, John Englander, who was talking about rising seas. He's an author, and he was talking about this could be an economic advantage because we'll have all these opportunities to build new cities and maybe better cities, and it could be good for business. But I'm thinking, wow, it's not like we have an unlimited carbon budget left to spend, and it costs a lot of carbon to build anything, just to build a highway, just to pour concrete for buildings, a lot of carbon and all that. We don't have that margin, so it's possible that just the push to do something to solve this problem will add to the problem that caused it, will add to global warming. And so I just don't see a way out of that loop right now.
It's interesting that you mentioned John Englander, because he's slated to be one of our speakers in our series. He's been very generous to give us some of his time and working with him right now. But I think you know, that is a fair question. If we build in the way we've been building, you know, carbon intensive building, lots of concrete, lots of things like that, I think you're exactly right. I think there are ways again, you know, if we kind of start cultivating our imaginations, cultivating the possibilities and use our collective intelligence to come up with different kinds of solutions, there's ways we can deal with this. For instance, there's been discussion about the use of new forms of timber building that will have far fewer emissions as opposed to the embodied carbon in concrete. We can think about other sorts of solutions that are much, much less carbon intensive. In fact, you know, if we did this intelligently, this could be a way to actually create cities and places to live that are, you know, much less carbon intensive, that are much less spread out in some ways, and that demand households have multiple cars. And we can actually do a lot of positive things when it comes to addressing the carbon budget issue. Again, that's a big if, but I do think there's a possibility we could do that. And it's pretty exciting to think what can be done.
And what about you, Patrick? Where do you live? Is it climate resistant? And would you consider moving somewhere else?
I currently live in Kansas City, Missouri, in the almost dead center geographically in the United States. I've lived a lot of places, and I'm sure I'll live a lot of places in the future. The house that my family and I recently purchased, one of the first things we were looking at is the sewage lines and sort of the resilience to increasingly heavy rain events, which we have seen this year. They seem to be happening more and more. And so I think there's resilience we can. It's one of the few walkable communities in this city. You know, when it comes to moving, I think that's, I foresee that definitely in my future in terms of relocating for the sake of my children as well. I want them to have sort of the opportunities to have that better life. And, you know, I think Kansas City is going to be one of the, I would bet it's going to be one of the major receiving communities simply by virtue of being away from the coast. But places like this are not without their challenges. We see the dry line marching across the continent every few years. We see the issue of simply heat and humidity. It's going to become more and more oppressive. So yeah, I think I'm going to be one of those migrants.
Well, as we wrap up here, could you just tell us, what is climatemigration.org?
Climatemigration.org is the Climate Migration Network's website. This has been an initiative of the Consensus Building Institute out of Boston, trying to bring together a lot of different thinkers and academics and such around the issue of climate migration. One of the interesting things about looking on the Internet is that it's a very new conversation, and there's a lot of scattered people doing a lot of excellent work, but nobody's really started kind of lassoing them in a bit and getting them to talk to each other. You know, there's some really interesting stuff going on, an organization out of Britain, and there's a university somewhere in, I think, Belgium that's done some work. But, you know, we're really at the early stage of getting everyone to talk to each other, and that's something I've been personally trying to do, reaching out and introducing myself and seeing if there's ways we can collaborate. But, again, it's really early, and we'll see how it goes.
Well, if you find some links that you think would interest our listeners to follow up, please send them my email, and I'll include them in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Our guest, Patrick Marchman, is a certified environmental planner who is leading the discussion about how to plan for our new climate future instead of waiting for disasters and panic. Good luck, Patrick, and please stay in touch with any new developments.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. Patrick Marchman mentioned the new Rob Hopkins book coming out in the middle of October. Rob is the co-founder of the Transition Towns movement, an inspiration for many localization efforts around the world. Rob will be our guest next week on Radio EcoShock. Also next week, we are going to guess at our climate future with expert scientific help. Patrick Brown from San Jose may have some surprises for us. I want to ask him about a paper saying that a braking mechanism on our apparent civilization's suicide may be around. It's awful to think, but perhaps climate damage will be so severe it will slow the economy. As Professor Tim Garrett told us on this show a couple of years ago, with fossil fuels, the economy is a heat engine. When the economy roars, so do greenhouse gas emissions. That is happening right now. We just had a big increase in greenhouse gas pollution over the last year and a half, another record again. But if things fall apart, maybe that will save us from a worse fate? Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock for more in a perverse universe. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for your support and for caring about our world.
Johnson Castle.